Ticks have been turning up in more places than ever before, and over the past two decades, tick-borne illnesses have increased, especially in the Northeast. For this week's Please Explain, we thought that we'd find out more about why these tiny arachnids have been around and how to prevent the problems they cause. Joining us are Dr. Thomas Mather, director of the University of Rhode Island Center for Vector-Borne Disease and its Tick Encounter Resource Center, and Dr. Thomas Daniels, associate research scientist and co-director of the Vector Ecology Laboratory at Fordham University's Louis Calder Center. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, thanks for having me as well.
And I'm a little concerned because both of you are named Thomas, so I can't say, well, what do you think about that, Thomas? We also invite our listeners to join the conversation. Give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So should I call both of you Doctor? Dr. Daniels?
Tom is fine.
Tom, for which one of you?
Tom Daniels.
Okay, and Thomas Mather, how's that?
That's fine, or you could just refer to him as the good-looking one.
Okay, well, with the good-looking one. Why is it that there are more ticks in more places now than there used to be?
I'm not sure. We do see that the tick population is sort of expanding into areas where it hasn't been before. A lot of that has to do with the fact that we're better at counting ticks. A lot of it has to do with the fact that we've opened up habitats for ticks and moved into tick habitat in areas where we hadn't been before. So we're better at getting ourselves sick is part of it.
And well, are there the habitats that they thrive in to be found all over the country or all over the world for that matter?
Well, I'm going to jump in if you don't mind.
Okay, Thomas.
I think that one reason for the expansion of ticks in general, and certainly black-legged ticks in our area, probably Lone Star ticks as you're down in the New Jersey, New York area as well, has to do with the increasing populations of deer. Now, maybe Tom doesn't exactly agree with that. He might, but both of those ticks thrive in the adult stages on deer, and that's important for tick reproduction. And these deer are coming closer and closer to where people live, and I believe that also has a big role to play in bringing people and ticks in closer proximity.
Well, I agree with Thomas on that regard. certainly, we've got more deer in the country now than we've ever had in our history. We don't have a very good way of managing deer populations, and clearly we've got more deer than we've had, and the tick species that Tom mentioned are they thrive on large mammals like white-tailed deer. We don't have large populations of the black-legged tick, for example, in the absence of white-tailed deer.
So, well, I was just recently in the San Juan Islands in the Puget Sound, and there were a lot of deer, but I'm assuming that they weren't carrying the ticks because they're so far away from our area.
No, that's probably not true. I mean, I think that up in that area, they have black-legged ticks. They're called Western black-legged ticks out there, and they certainly have Lyme disease.
Now, are the deer themselves immune to Lyme disease? Is that how they can carry it?
Well, you know, we did studies years ago that here at the University of Rhode Island that showed quite clearly that deer have a unique innate immune system that responds specifically to the Lyme disease bacteria, basically preventing them from developing high enough levels of infection to pass the bacteria on to ticks that feed on them. Certainly, they're exposed. I mean, they get bitten by hundreds and hundreds of infected tick bites, but somehow their immune system, unlike ours, is able to regulate the infection to a very low level. So they're not really impacted, we don't believe. They certainly don't serve as reservoirs that are involved in the spillover of the bacteria into ticks that affect people. For that, we need small rodents for the most part. Don't you agree, Tom?
I do. So the other side of that coin is that while deer don't seem to be reservoir competent, white-footed mice, a variety of rodents, chipmunks, for example, some medium-sized mammals, all of these species are contributing to the population of infected ticks because they can not only harbor the agents that make us sick, but transmit them back to feeding ticks, which may or may not be infected when they actually get on the host, but can very well be infected once they finish feeding.
Now, Connecticut is where Lyme disease was first discovered. Does it have a bigger tick problem than other states? Was it just an accident that we started noticing it in Lyme, Connecticut?
I don't know. I don't know if it was an accident. It was certainly fortuitous that a woman named Polly Murray noticed within her own family and then within her community this strange assortment of symptoms that later was attributed to black-legged ticks and called Lyme disease. I think in terms of, you know, sort of looking at it retrospectively, people kind of knew that something was going on. We just didn't know what to call it. There were, historic records of people on Long Island with Montauk knee, which is more than likely, the swollen joint that comes along with Lyme disease. And this goes way back into the 1800s. So I'm sure we had it here. It wasn't anything that was new. A lot of times people think there's this conspiracy theory out there that the government, was involved in bringing it through their lab on Plum Island out there off of Long Island. And, I really think that makes for maybe exciting reading. I don't think there's much validity to it. There's plenty of evidence that suggests that there were Lyme disease-infected ticks going back well into the 1800s.
But the big question is, why this explosion now?
Well, what happened at the time, and we're talking about back in the mid to late 1970s when Lyme disease was first identified, is that the deer population had been on the rise for a long period of time, but we also started to see, and the tick population started to grow, and it wasn't, it almost had to reach a critical mass before enough people were getting sick from this pathogen that was being transmitted. And as Tom mentioned, it had been around for at least 100 years before enough people were getting sick, and there was, in a sense, an epidemic in this one spot in Old Lyme, Connecticut. And there was enough of a question raised by the residents as to why they were having these symptoms that we actually began looking. And when we started looking for this tick, we started to notice that it wasn't just in Connecticut. It was also in New York. But the populations were very, very low. And over the intervening three decades, we've seen the population grow quite a bit. We've had epidemics up and down the Hudson Valley. And it's essentially stabilized so that we've got a tick population that's not going away, but it's also not getting any worse at this point.
Well, a listener, Bob from Mountainside, wants to know if the increase in ticks is related to the banning of DDT.
Yeah, I really don't think that's the case. That might appear to be the case, but I think that we can just attribute it to the growth of the deer population that's allowed the tick population to swell. There's an evolution of our landscapes. Clearly, if you look at pictures, at least of most of the Northeast, in particular, I'm thinking of Rhode Island, there really weren't trees here in the late 1800s. There were a lot of stone walls, but, deer prefer trees to hide in, and they just weren't around. And without a reproductive host for these ticks just weren't really around in great densities either.
Now,
that's all changed, and I don't think it really had anything to do with banning DDT.
Now, female mosquitoes are the ones who bite. What about ticks? Do males and females both bite?
The female is the stage. The tick life cycle is a bit complicated. The larval stage, which hatches from the egg, is very, very small. It's generally not infected with anything, and that bites. That will feed on anything. But there's no gender at this point. Even though it's predetermined, and it will at some point become a male or a female. At this point, it's not one sex or the other. The stage responsible for most Lyme disease and virtually all of the diseases we're talking about is the nymphal stage. Again, it's genderless, and it will feed on virtually anything. If that particular nymph happens to be lucky enough to find a host and actually become an adult, then we'll see male and female, and at that point, it's generally the females. Only the females are going to take a blood meal. The males may or may not imbibe or take in a little bit of tissue fluid simply to keep themselves going. Their job at that point is simply to find a female to reproduce. Female's job is simply to find a blood meal so that she can lay eggs.
My guests are Thomas Daniels of Fordham University and Thomas Mather of the University of Rhode Island. We are talking about tick-borne diseases on today's Please Explain. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A number of listeners have written in about ticks on dogs. Evelyn on Twitter asks, our dog was diagnosed with Lyme today. Our neighbor's dog has Lyme. How common is it in pets? Another listener, Richard in Brooklyn, wants to know, Liz on Facebook says dogs can get a vaccine against tick-borne Lyme disease. Why can't humans?
So let me try and unpack those questions a little bit. Dogs clearly are just a little bit more exposed than people, even though they're often on the other end of the leash. They are a little bit more free-spirited, so they tend to walk back and forth across a trail. And the ticks are along the edges of the trails. Good tick smart tip is to keep walking in the middle of the trail. So they're probably more exposed. And then once a tick latches on, the ticks are harder to find because they have all of that fur, so that the ticks are likely to bite and stay attached for longer, making transmission more opportune. But it is interesting. Our studies going back years now have shown that certain breeds of dogs are far more susceptible to infection than others. In particular, we noticed that beaglehounds were relatively resistant to coming down with infection, while retrievers in particular and poodles also are pretty susceptible to more serious disease when it comes to Lyme disease and actually other infections we haven't really mentioned, but anaplasmosis is one.
I wanted to get to those in a moment, but I was wondering whether the diseases can be passed on from the dog to humans.
Well, we did a study back in the 90s that showed that dogs can serve as reservoirs just like mice and chipmunks. But the good news there is most people treat their dogs so they don't really get a ton of tick feedings. I don't think there's very many ticks in the backyard that have been infected because of an infected dog. But that said, it is possible, I suppose. So it's another good reason to keep your dog on preventive medicine, year-round.
Do different kinds of ticks carry different diseases?
As a matter of fact, they do. The black-legged tick, which seems to be a virtual Pandora's box of pathogens, is a little bit unusual in that we have anaplasma, babesia, borrelia, of a virus-like agent, a variety of things that can transmit. Rocky Mountain spotted fever, though, is an organism that's in this part of the country pretty much restricted to the American dog tick, and we actually have cases of that in New York City. Amblyomma americanum is also responsible for transmitting one or two agents, but generally speaking, the agents seem to be specialized among a variety of tick species, the black-legged tick being a bit of an exception.
Now, do all of them kind of manifest themselves similarly? If I'm bitten by a tick, will it always have the kind of earmarks that I associate with Lyme disease?
Yeah, the different diseases definitely have some similarities. They often present as flu-like symptoms, and it's noticeable because they tend to be, tick-borne diseases tend to have more of a summertime occurrence as opposed to normal flu, which is more of a wintertime occurrence. So summertime flu-like illness, feeling achy, run down, headaches, fever, are a good, suggestion that tick-borne disease is involved. But so are, there's mosquito-borne diseases that exhibit those things. And then there's other things, too, like just regular, bacterial infections. But the Lyme disease infection often has a telltale rash associated with it. It's been described as a bullseye. But the other infections, anaplasma, babesia, they don't come with a rash like that.
And there isn't always the bullseye rash with Lyme either.
Yeah, that's true. It's probably more frequent than people sometimes surmise. I guess, you know, there's a lot of different reports out there about the presence of or absence of, you know, a rash associated with disease. But, you know, it's possible that sometimes people think they have Lyme disease, but they may actually have some of these other infections that they just didn't test for.
Let's take a call before we go to our break. Melanie from New Jersey, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm calling to see if either of the doctors are familiar with the disease that from the Lone Star tick that gives alpha gal, it's called, which makes people allergic to all red meat, mammalian meat.
I've read those reports, and I've actually spoken with the investigator down at in Virginia.
Yes.
It's an interesting observation.
This really just a conspiracy being spread by vegans?
I'm not sure about that. I don't know. What do you think, Tom?
Nothing's ever that simple.
Yeah.
Well, is it possible that you can develop an allergy to red meat from being bitten by a tick?
You know, that's certainly what their hypothesis is.
The data seem to be suggesting that. We haven't seen many cases of this, but it does look like something we're going to have to keep an eye on in the future.
We have to take a little break, and we'll come back with more calls, more of the things that people have written in to our show page, to Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. The telephone number to call is 212-433-9692. We're talking about tick-borne illnesses. When we come back, we'll also talk a bit about those ticks and what to look for in case you think that you may have been bitten. Our guests are Thomas Mather, director of the University of Rhode Island Center for Vector-Borne Disease and its Tick Encounter Resource Center, and Thomas Daniels, associate research scientist and co-director of the Vector Ecology Laboratory at Fordham University's Lewis Calder Center. And we are back with our guest, Thomas Mather of the University of Rhode Island, Thomas Daniels of Fordham University. We're talking about ticks on today's Please Explain. So if I have been out walking in the woods and I want to check for ticks, is there a method for doing it to make sure that I'm looking for the right thing, Tom?
I would say the method is fairly straightforward, you're right to raise the point about making sure that you do it. That's the first step, is to make sure that you you've agreed to, if you're going to go out, spend some time making sure that you check yourself afterward.
Because you wouldn't normally know unless you looked?
You're not necessarily going to know. These ticks are very, very good. You know, that they've been around couple hundred million years, and they've gotten really good at avoiding detection. They've got a variety of chemicals in their saliva, and maybe Tom can mention and talk a little bit more about that later, that allow them to sort of get a free ride without being detected. So a lot of times you'll be bitten by a tick and not realize it. And you need to essentially run your hands over your body as well as look, particularly in relatively inaccessible places, because that's where the ticks are likely to be. They seek out exposed skin, they attach, and they're likely to be, if it's a good spot, they're likely to be there for several days. And so you've got some time to check yourself, but we always recommend that the sooner you do it, the better, because if they are infected, you're sort of working against the clock to make sure that you get that tick off before it has had time to transmit whatever pathogen it has.
If you do find a tick, what's the best way to remove it? Isn't it important to do it correctly?
Well, I think it's important that you grab it as close to the skin as you can with a fine tip forceps and pull it out. That is probably the safest way. There are a variety of methods that have been proposed in the past, from burning the tick with a match to trying to suffocate it with petroleum jelly. All of those are risky endeavors. They may facilitate transmission, or they may simply take too long. And since you are trying to beat the clock, it's better just to grab it and pull it out.
And Thomas, I guess
yeah, I'd like to add, when we're talking about searching for ticks and removing, it's really, really important that you kind of have a sense of what you're looking for. So what I like to do is have people think about the poppy seed bagel that they like to eat for breakfast. And we actually do this in demonstrations all the time. We've, you know, attached some ticks to a poppy seed bagel, and we ask people to find the tick, and they can't because they really are that size. And so if you're not used to bending over or looking down below your belt for something the size of a poppy seed, then that's something that would be a good thing to start doing. And then, you know, some of the strategies that, you know, folklore tells us that, you know, burn that off with a match or a cigarette. I mean, I don't mean to be crude, but I wouldn't want to be the one trying to touch a cigarette to the back end of a poppy seed that's attached to the back of my testicles, you know?
So, but you have to still very carefully pull them off.
Right.
What should you do with the tick
really
after you remove
it? Way. Yeah, pointy tweezers are the best way. We have a great video, actually, believe it or not, more than 3 million people have looked at it, so that's a lot of ticks that people want to remove safely using pointy tweezers on our tick and count.
And after you remove it, what should you do with it?
We generally recommend hanging on to it, and if you realize it's a tick, put it into either a Ziploc bag with just to seal it in there, or a small container of alcohol. And the reason we suggest that is because if a person does become sick in the subsequent week or two, and sick enough to want to go see a physician, it helps sometimes to have that specimen.
If you have the tick, back in the day, people used to just get rid of them, flick them off in panic, or throw them down the toilet or something. But after what we were discussing earlier, that each type of tick is associated with different infections, it's really important. So this is like a paradigm shift we're trying to accomplish here. Tom and I, in particular, we'd like people to save that tick, use resources that are available online to identify that tick, and you'll be better able to know what infection you might be at risk for getting. In particular, knowing that American dog ticks don't give you Lyme disease, it will give people an awful lot of peace of mind if they realize, oh, I was bitten by an American dog tick. I guess I shouldn't really be talking about Lyme disease here. Maybe Rocky Mountain spotted fever, but not Lyme disease. So please save the tick and identify it.
Now, will bug repellents like DEET or OFF repel ticks?
They do. They work. They're very, very effective. DEET's been around since the 1940s, and it's probably the single most effective repellent that you can use. There are a variety of botanicals that have come along since, and some other artificial repellents that are almost as effective, but they certainly do work. And we do recommend that when people are going to be putting themselves in the line of fire, so to speak, when they go out, it's not a bad idea at all to use repellents. Follow the directions that are there and reapply as necessary, but it's always a good idea too.
Now, Thomas, there's a photograph on our website.
I'm going to have to respectfully disagree a little bit about that.
Go ahead.
We focus on using a very effective strategy where your clothing is repellent rather than relying on DEET. There's evidence that suggests that, you know, DEET maybe works briefly as a repellent against ticks. It's quite fine as a repellent against mosquitoes, but that generally speaking, people put it on their exposed skin, but if ticks can get beyond that little barrier, they get to untreated skin, then they're happy to bite. But that, you know, these ticks crawl up underneath your clothes. If your clothes are treated with permethrin as a clothing repellent, it actually does a very effective job at preventing tick bites. There's been a couple of studies published now that describe that, and there are, you know, clothes that you can buy, clothes that you can treat yourself, and you can actually take your own clothes and send them to the company that treats them for, you know, major manufacturers, and have the same kind of treatment on your own clothes.
You know that you're going to be in an area where there are a lot of deer or some of the other tick-bearing animals, do different ticks prefer different hosts to feed on? Do dog ticks only feed on dogs, or are they likely to also bite humans?
most of the ticks that we're talking, actually, if you don't mind, I just want to add something to what Tom just said about the repellents, and I might be considered respectfully disagreeing with him in this
it's
regard.
It's okay. We like controversy on this show.
Yeah, lots of people go out, and if you can treat your clothes with permethrin, and there's a product called Permanone, and it works very well. We use it for tick suits. And I recommend that. But lots of people go out in shorts. They go out with exposed skin. They don't have clothing in all the areas where they're going to get a tick attached to them initially. And a repellent can be very, very effective in preventing that tick from getting on in the first place, and at a point where it's not even going to reach the clothing. And so treating your clothes is great, but repellents, I wouldn't not use them in this case.
No, I'm not saying not use them. I'm pretty much agreeing with you, but I think that we can, even with summer weight clothes, we can get great protection from tick bites if we just, you know, what we see is that people, oh yeah, that's a great idea, and then you ask them later if they did it, and they oh no, I, or if they buy a, you know, pants from a, you know, REI or an outfitter or something, and they say, you know, they're not going to take their dog on a walk with those pants because they're special, because they cost so much.
Mm.
It's
actually,
like, but that's when you're at risk. You need to wear them then.
You know, you've actually raised a very, very important point. We talk about being able to avoid tick bites, and we're very good at it. We've been doing this a long time, and we know what to look for. We know how to prepare ourselves for the field. We know what clothes to wear. We tape up. We take every precaution, and I've had Lyme disease 3 times. And so the average individual who goes out and is just taking advantage of the wilderness is not always going to get every tick that they might come in contact with, which brings us back to efforts to control tick populations, because personal protection, as much as we want to do it and as much as we want to hope that it will be effective, in general terms, isn't as effective as it needs to be.
Let's take a call from Mike from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Pleasure to speak with you. I was bitten twice this year, and you know, researched it quite thoroughly. I removed the ticks. I don't think they were embedded all that long with the tweezers, and wiped it down with alcohol and put some antibiotic on it, kept an eye on it. Now, it did develop a sort of a scab, which took quite a while to heal. And the other thing was, when I do find a tick, what I do is sandwich it between a couple pieces of scotch tape with the date on it, just in case I need to have it checked out in the future for any kind of infection or disease. And the other thing that I mentioned to the screener was that applying any type of a substance to the body forces the tick to go deeper into the host, and will possibly regurgitate some of its fluid into the host as a self-defense mechanism. Is that accurate?
Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, you know, we worry about that a little bit. I think that, generally speaking, dead ticks don't spit anything into you, so that's another good reason to use the permethrin. I mean, in trials that we did here, we had people wearing treated and untreated summer weight clothes, and even if the tick had a chance to attach before it was killed, most of the ticks that we found attached to people were dead, and once they're dead, they really aren't doing any spitting. You know, the what you mentioned at the outset of your question, though, the reaction that you got, that's very typical, and sometimes it leads people to believe that that's the Lyme disease rash, the little red papule that forms around the tick bite. It really has to grow to greater than a 50-cent piece or more for it to even be, you know, sort of characterized as the Lyme disease rash. But this rash that you were talking about probably occurred within the first 30 to 50 hours after the tick attached, and that's really a response to the tick saliva, the saliva that the tick is spitting into you. You've probably been exposed to these ticks before, so this, you know, the person that's never been bitten before probably wouldn't get that kind of a reaction, but people that have been exposed a few times do get a skin reaction, and sometimes that that can persist for weeks to even longer, and it can be quite itchy. And we get a lot of emails from folks telling us about this. And one thing that might help is some topical antihistamine cream that would take that away.
Now, we have very little time left. People have been asking about bullseyes that don't lead to Lyme disease. You kind of address that. But what about false negatives? Hasn't that been a problem?
False negatives with respect to testing people
yes.
to see whether or not they've been exposed.
Yes.
Yeah, that's fairly it's not uncommon given the way that this pathogen operates. And so you're infected with this organism. It's in your body. Your body is going to respond to it, but it takes some time for the body to develop enough antibodies that can be detected by the systems that we have now for testing. And so it can take up to 6 to 8 weeks before you've generated enough antibodies to be detected. And so initially, if you take a blood test very early on after the tick bite, you could very well have been infected with the Lyme disease agent, but it's not going to show up as a positive result for weeks. And that's why we always recommend hanging on to the tick. And if you start to feel bad, go see the doctor. A lot of times the diagnostic criteria are such that a doctor will make a diagnosis before the
We have a link to the University of Rhode Island's Tick Encounter Resource Center where people can get more information to identify ticks and learn more about them at WNYC.org. My great thanks to Drs. Thomas Mather and Thomas Daniels for being on today's Please Explain. On Monday's show, urban anthropologist Elizabeth Greenspan looks into the tensions between commerce and commemoration at Ground Zero. And then Peter von Zygesar talks about growing up among Long Island's Gilded Age families and becoming the keeper of his homeless schizophrenic stepbrother, also the director and star of the film Short Term 12 about the employees of a facility for at-risk teens, and director Lee Daniels and screenwriter Danny Strong discuss their new film, Lee Daniels, The Butler. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Julia Corcoran, and Jessica Miller. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Debbie Darter was at the audio controls. We had help today from Ankita Sood and Helen Rauner. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.